Okay, thank you for that introduction. This thing, I don't know if it's working so well, mm-hmm. cutting in and out. I've got a copy of that here.
Okay.
Yes, so my name is Venerable Mudu, and I've been living at Bodhinyana Monastery for, it's my 7th year now. So I'm a local boy, I grew up in Sorrento, a beachside suburb. I was a surf lifesaver, so I'll give a quick bio. I was a surf lifesaver for most of my life, and I felt that was a wonderful thing, being a surf lifesaver. It's not, there's a lot of similarities to being a monk, because when you're a surf lifesaver, you're a volunteer, and you give your time to looking after all the people that come to the beach, make sure they're safe and protected, and that they go home in one piece, not in two pieces like after being bitten by a shark, which kind of happens sometimes, but never on my watch, so it was good. I basically grew up in Sorrento, had a wonderful time, worked my way through the schooling, I failed English, so I couldn't get into university, so I went to TAFE, which was very good because I don't think I would have enjoyed all the work I would have had to do at university. So I had a good time at TAFE. That got me a diploma in engineering, so learning similar stuff to what engineers learn at university, but it got me into a job that is drafting, engineering design. So I did all my years of drafting, working for CBH. CBH handled all the grain in WA. So I was looking after the design of all their storages, both the storages in the wheat belt and the ship loading facilities, truck loading facilities, rail loading facilities. And I met lots of good people in my life as a draftsman. Also did work on the Kwinana Strip, which is famous for its chemical processing, so I was also responsible for all those nasty toxins that go into the environment, that go into making our mobile phones and cars and all that sort of stuff. And you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. But that was good. I basically got married, had a child. Very soon after that, I found it very difficult to live with married. And so we separated and we spent the next 12 years in the family law court fighting over our daughter. I had one arm, my wife had the other arm, and we had a tug of war. 12 years. The family law court doing that drove me almost insane, not quite, just about. And I had a friend at the time, and after I went to my dentist, he said, "Oh, you know, you're grinding your teeth, you should look at meditation." So that's how it all started. And a friend of mine was Thai, and she said, "Why don't you come to the monastery in Serpentine?" And I'm going, "Oh, what's all that about, you know, all these Asian people at the monastery, I won't know what to say, I can't speak Thai." So off I go. She said, "Just come along, don't worry, just come and eat." So I can do that, that's pretty easy. So she loads up the boot of her car with all this food. She spent all morning cooking it. I'm like, "What are you cooking all this food for? How many people are you feeding? You know, do you know these monks?" She says, "No." She says, "I just like doing it." So I follow her along to the monastery, and then she says, "Oh, you've got to line up here and you get to put rice in the monk's bowls. So you just line up and just copy what I do." So I did that, and then the first person that walks down the stairs and comes down to have what they call Bindabat was Ajahn Brahm. And he didn't look Asian. He looked like a Westerner. So I was completely blown off. And the next person were all Westerners. And I was like, "Oh my goodness, something actually inside me moved, and I kind of, I was completely blown away, because I was expecting something else, because I'd only seen documentaries on monasteries, and they were always Asian monks, so the Buddhist monks are Asian, so I thought that was what I was expecting, and it wasn't the case. So this is available to anybody, this monastic life. So I kept going for several years, and I learned meditation. I found out about Nolamara, and I learned the meditation, and this kind of family law court thing kind of dragged on, like I said, for 12 years. And in the end, we got this decision from the court that my daughter could choose who she wanted to stay with. And she said, "I want to stay with Dad." And I'm like, "Yes." Well, that was wonderful. And so my wife decided to go and live as far away as possible from me. She wasn't very happy. She just finished her teaching degree, so she goes to live in the wheat belt, Kanama to start with. And so she comes down, and I said, "You know, come down and see Georgia whenever you like. You know, she's it's cool." One day she came down and she didn't bring her back. And I'm like, "Oh my goodness, I've got to go back to court again, I've got to do all this. I can't do it. I don't ever want to go back into that." It was like a hell realm. The last time I visited, I said, "I'm never going back to this place." And so I talked to my lawyer. He says, "Yeah, you've got to go back to court and everything." And I just decided, well, I'll let go. And I had some good advice from some good Buddhists, and they said, if it's all cool and your daughter's happy and your wife's happy, just let go. And so that's what I did. I thought, I'll come and have a go at being a monk and see what that's like. And I haven't looked back. It's been great. My daughter, and that was 7 years ago. Actually, no, 9, because I spent a couple of years getting the house sold and all my possessions sold and everything. And my daughter's now come back to Rockingham, and she's studying at university, and she's happy and catch up all the time, and it's all good. And I also kind of had, you might have heard Ajahn Brahm's story about the forgiveness ceremony. I had the forgiveness ceremony. I had a go of that with my ex-wife, and that turned out to be a really big success. I can save that story for another day, but everything between us is quite good too. And the whole weight lifted off my shoulders when I practiced that forgiveness ceremony with her. Mind you, it was 7 years later, so we had a lot of time. And the last thing she said to me was, "I'll see you at the wedding." Meaning the wedding of our daughter. So that was a sign that she had forgiven me, and I think that was a wonderful thing. So that's some good advice, is to try and get those any kind of enemies or things that are unfinished, always try and finish those off. You don't want to take those to your grave with you. It helps you sleep easier at night as well. But so that's a bit of background. I basically come to the monastery. I'm very, very happy being a monk. So I recently was asked to come down to Albany. So some of you might have heard about the Albany Project. Well, that's my baby. So I was invited. My brother lives in Albany. He invited me to come down there. I said, "Well, I can't really do that, to come and see family. But if there's a bigger reason, then maybe we could work something out." So he says, "Oh, well, I know some Thai people in Albany, and they like monks. So maybe I can organise you to do a talk or something." So he talked to the Thai community. His daughters were going to school with a Thai girl, and that they were good friends of the family. And he, when he told this Thai community that his brother was a monk, they were like, "Oh my God, get him down here. We'd love to have a monk come down and visit us." It's quite a long way. For those of you who don't know where Albany is, it's 4 hours from my monastery where I am. So they don't get a lot of monks going down there. So they made a formal invitation through Ajahn Brahm. Can we please have Venerable Mudu come down to visit us and do a blessing of our restaurant? So I went down there, and Ajahn Brahm said, when you go down to do the blessing, please do a public talk and visit one of the prisons as well. So 18 months later, I'm now giving 4 public talks, teaching at the 2 prisons, and have an invitation from the community down there to establish a monastery, which Ajahn Brahm agreed to, and the BSWA, and Ajahn Brahm are fully backing the development of a branch, the first official Bodhinyana branch monastery to be in the Great Southern of Western Australia. Things are moving along with that. Little hurdles here and there to get over, but we're getting there. And I'm quite excited about that, and there's a lot of support down there. There's a big community down there, and I've reached out to, you know, because I'm a local West Australian. I was a surf lifesaver, so I go and visit the surf lifesaving club down there, and I remind those guys, because they don't seem to get it. These guys are so happy, and they have like this sense of happiness. Why do they have that sense of happiness? Well, it's because they give without expecting anything in return. These guys look after the beaches and make sure that everyone is safe so they can return home to their families every day. I remind those guys of that, and they're like, oh, I think you're right. That's why they have this sense of happiness, and it is one of the best Australian institutions that I'm aware of. It's such a healthy thing, right through from little ones, I think 8 years old or something.
The nippers.
Nippers, yeah. I started as a nipper. And Sorrento Surf Life Saving Club. I get stung by blue bottle jellyfish every weekend. I'm immune to those things now. They don't sting me at all. They don't hurt. But so because I'm local, it's easier for me to kind of reach out to the community down there. So I've got contacts with the local newspapers, and they come down and they took a photo of me in the surf boat, because I used to be a surf boat rower. For those of you who don't know what surf boats are, they were the original boats that they would go and rescue people in. They look like whaling boats, these huge big boats. Well, I learned to be a sweep, which is like the skipper. And I had a women's crew, and I was training them just before I became a monk. So the newspaper photographer got me to stand in the back of one of these boats holding the sweep oar, and it's called a sweep because the action you do is a bit like sweeping. And he's very clever, this guy. He's the editor of the newspaper, and he's done an article on me just about every time I've gone down there, so very supportive. And the title of that was Monk Sweeps into Town. He's very, very clever. He's promoting what I'm doing down there. He's valuing it. Yeah. And so is the other newspaper. And the ABC Radio had me on there a couple of times as well. And they're very supportive as well. So I can see Albany is going to be really good. It's going to be very good for the community. And, you know, I'm going there to teach meditation. So far, this has been really good. So I'll just see. We've got 10 more minutes. I'm just going to give some. Yes, we'll do the Metta Sutta, and then we'll go into the meditation. I'll give a little brief introduction to my method of meditation, which is not unlike what you would have heard Ajahn Brahm say. I mean, his method is so good. I don't see any point in kind of changing from that. But I love this sutta. It's definitely my favourite, and I'm used to chanting in Pali, so I'm going to use the cheat sheet. So, we'll start with this. I'm not shy with chanting, so I recommend you chant nice and loud. And one of the techniques is to, you can feel your skull vibrating when you chant. If you could get that resonance going, huh? That's what Bhante Siddhartha said. He said you should be able to feel that vibration in your body. But so we'll start with
hanging on to Mahali.
It could be something, a great leftover resonance from that. Yeah, they're pretty loud. So we'll start with the Namortasa first, and then go into this. So those of you who don't know the chanting, just follow along with the cheat sheet, or just read it. You don't have to read it out if you don't feel comfortable. But this is the Buddha's words on loving kindness, and basically that's, you know, what the Buddha represented. He gave his loving kindness to everybody. He's a bit like Ajahn Brahm is like that. He's just always kind, loving in the sense of being kind and caring. That's the kind of way I look at that description. And this sutta, or kind of like a song, goes and explains all of the ways that you can spread that loving kindness. And sometimes it sounds a bit gag worthy to people who haven't chanted it before, but Ajahn Brahm's advice, if you have that feeling, is to fake it until you make it. And I can guarantee you that if you follow this and you do chant it and you keep meditating, you come along to the group meditations, you'll feel that loving kindness. I can almost guarantee you that, or your money back. Okay, so let's let it rip. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born. May all beings be happy. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life the child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded,
from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So, yeah, we'll move on to the meditation. Now, why on earth would we want to meditate? That's a good question to ask. Is it because it's hip and popular at the moment? It's really cool to do? It's more than that. It is hip and popular and cool to do. But the best explanation I have heard for why we should meditate is a story that Ajahn Brahm has told several times, quite a few, more than several. And that is when he was staying with Ajahn Chah, and a professor from America came to visit Ajahn Chah's monastery to find out what all this hoo-ha was about for meditation, what it actually did. And he came with all his measuring apparatus and his machines that go beep and all this sorts of stuff, and try to scientifically measure what was going on. So he asked Ajahn Chah, why do you meditate? And Ajahn Chah answered it very simply. And he said, if you want a fit and healthy body, then you need to eat well and exercise. If you want a healthy mind, then you must meditate. It's as simple as that. That's how I see the benefit of meditation, is for a healthy mind. I know myself, if I miss my meditation, if I'm doing too much work at the monastery, I am a busy monk, because I do all the plans for the monastery, all the engineering drawings, then if I fall behind on my meditation, I don't do quite enough, I find myself getting more easily grumpy. Not only with my fellow monastics, but my parents live close by too, so if I visit them, you know, I can get grumpy easier. So that's a really good gauge, grumpy meter. If your grumpy meter's kind of rising, then you need to do more meditation. That's as simple as that. Now, meditation's quite easy. Today's meditation is not going to be advanced class, because for me, meditation's always the same every time. It's pretty simple. I failed English at school, so I have learnt my meditation techniques not from textbooks. I've learnt them through the teachings of Ajahn Brahm, so an oral tradition. I've listened to what he says and what the other monks say, mainly Ajahn Brahm, but we have Ajahn Brahmali and other teachers there. But most of my instructions have come from my teacher, Ajahn Brahm. And I don't read a lot of books. I find it difficult to read, and my eyes get sore and I start to fall asleep when I read. So all of my teachings come, you know, from what I've heard Ajahn Brahm say. And I feel I've had success with the meditation techniques he's taught. They work for me. So the techniques I'll teach today are a kind of a selection of stuff that he's taught me that work for me. And meditation does require some practice. Sometimes we get beginner's luck and we have a peaceful meditation off the cuff straight away. But it usually requires a little bit of practice, and you start to get familiar with some of the things that come up in the mind. Because essentially when we meditate, we're hanging out with our mind. That's all we're doing. We're just spending some time with ourselves. And we can get confused or overburdened with a lot of literature we've seen and stuff on telly we've seen about how to meditate, how you got to sit, how you got to have your hands, you got to sit full lotus, you have to sit cross-legged, you have to have your hands like this, you have to be like that, all this kind of stuff. And it's not really so important. The important part for meditation is to sit comfortable for a short period of time. Usually we do this meditation here for half an hour, which is a nice amount of time to meditate. And for people who haven't done it before, nice to be in a very comfortable chair, not necessarily sitting on the floor where it might be uncomfortable. But I can sit on the floor provided I've got a lot of cushions. Mm-hmm. And that's what I do at my hut. I meditate on my bed. That's when I meditate. I've got a nice mattress on my bed, so I put a pillow under each knee. I sit cross-legged, so my legs are comfy. I have two cushions behind my back and I'm really comfy. So that's the first thing I do. I make sure I'm comfortable. And then when we move into the next part of the meditation, and I don't like to explain meditation as having so many parts and step one, step two, three, four, five. It's more simple than that. Like I said at the start, it's hanging out with your mind and just being friends with your mind and watching your mind become peaceful or watching your mind become agitated. But the more practice we do, we tend to watch our mind become peaceful. And that's the kind of object. Really, you don't want to force too many objects because you want to just let meditation happen by itself. You don't want to like tell it what to do. You just hang out with the mind and watch what's going on. Let your mind do what it wants to do. If it wants to think about things, if it wants to procrastinate about things and plan for the future and the past, you just let the mind do that. You observe it. You program your mind at the start that you want to have these thoughts kind of become less. And that actually does happen when you observe them. And you make peace and you be kind and be gentle with these thoughts that are going on in your mind, they eventually settle down anyway. And it always helps with a guided meditation because these instructions are kind of coming across and it helps anyway. But when you're meditating at home, it's a little bit harder. But group meditation is always a lot easier. So there's a couple of things. We're hanging out with our mind and we're making peace with whatever comes up in the mind, and we're watching it, and we just hang out with our mind, and the mind becomes still all by itself. And we're trying to watch out for things that happen while we're meditating. So we're watching for those little moments of peace. Try and be aware of those. Don't let them pass without noticing them. That's kind of being mindful. Watching when you see that moment of peace come up, and what do you see when you see a moment of peace? How does it feel? What does it look like? Well, it just kind of feels nice. It's a nice feeling. It's like everything just kind of like relaxes, and your body feels soft, and your mind feels soft, and there might not be any thoughts for a little bit. Might not last very long, but it might just be a moment or two. But try and capture that in a way that you can remember it and value it. And that's called being mindful of what's going on in your mind. And when you have a bank account of those little mindful moments, then you can reflect on them later on and go, well, yeah, that's what happened in my meditation, and I did get some moments of peace. And that's what we're kind of aiming for each time we meditate. So I'll guide through those things. But one more piece of advice before we start, and this is my mantra, not the kind of mantra that I kind of repeat, but it's my kind of catchphrase. It's Ajahn Brahm's words, but it's always worked for me, and I find them just the most beautiful three sets of three words. It's make peace. be kind and be gentle. If you do that with every moment and every thought that comes into your meditation, that's all you need to do. That's the very least you can do to be friends, to be able to hang out with your mind. Because you want to be friendly when you hang out with your mind. You don't want to be telling the thoughts to go away. I don't want you here, thoughts. You know, this is meditation time. You don't belong here. That's a bit of ill will. It's a bit of anger towards your own mind. And those sorts of things don't help. You just hang out with them. Go, there, mind. If you want to think about what we're planning for tomorrow, because it is a big event. I've got visitors coming for lunch and I need to make sure I go to the shops and get this, that and the other thing. And you just kind of like, we'll let the mind do that, but just say, you know, kind of gently nudge it into kind of leaving those things for after the meditation. So you just be kind. So you make peace, be kind, be gentle. So if you find yourself becoming a little bit agitated in your meditation, then you can be kind to that as well. Oh, agitation. You've come to visit me. How wonderful. Make peace, be kind, be gentle with it, and it will go away. After a little while, the more kind, the more friendly and gentle you are with it, probably the quicker it'll go away. So, and the other thing is, if you happen to nod off, that's great too. Don't worry. Just make peace with that as well. It happens to me all the time. And I just get a little power nap in for 10 or 15 minutes, and then I slowly, oh, I'm awake again. Oh, back to the meditation with a bit of extra energy because I've let my body do what it needed to do, which was to have a little rest. So, we start our meditation by getting as relaxed as we can. So if you need to scratch, move around, wiggle and wriggle, find a more comfortable location. If you find that you need to add another cushion to where you're sitting, then please do that. I can see there's three cushions in the corner over there. Does anyone need a cushion? They do. Yeah, cushions in the corner. So I'm going to do exactly what I've been saying. I'm going to adopt a little bit of a slouch position because that's comfortable for me. I certainly can't sit vertically upright, straight like a post. I'm a little, just lean back in the chair a little bit. And we go through each part of the body to make sure that it's relaxed and as comfortable as it could be. We also call this a body sweep meditation, this first part of the meditation. So we start, if I haven't already mentioned this, by closing our eyes. And we send our attention to our feet. And we say to our feet, are you comfortable, feet? Do you need to wriggle around? And if our feet are comfortable, then we just send some kindness, or we send some contact to our feet. We acknowledge our feet. Thank you, feet, for carrying me here today. There'll come a day then when I won't be able, when these feet won't be able to carry us here. But for the moment, for the time being, we're healthy and able. We're very lucky we can come here, join in with everyone doing this group meditation. So we just send the kindness to our feet, the toes, the muscles, the bones, the heels, the ankles. And we move that attention and awareness and kindness up the legs, the calf muscles. Again, just kind thoughts to those parts of our body that have been with us all our lives. The importance of sending kindness to these parts of our body is that it sets up the rest of the meditation. It sets up the bit where we get to come to our mind. We're already developing this kindness to the rest of our body, therefore it just naturally flows to the part of the body, to the mind, when we get to the mind part of the meditation. We move our awareness up to our knees. Any discomfort there? I've just got a little scratch on my knee. Give it a bit of an itch, give it a scratch. I'm slowly making the body comfortable so that it's ready for the rest of the 30-minute sit. Thank you, knees, for articulating the hundreds of thousands of times you've done that through my life. I move that kindness and awareness up through my upper leg muscles and into the hips. As we get older, the hips don't work as well, just like the knees, as they did when we were younger. But they're still working well enough to get us here today, for this sit. So thank you, legs and hips. And very gently and mindfully moving the awareness that we're developing and kindness into our tummies. Such an important part of the body, because it's where all of the digestion of the food that we have every day takes place. And what a wonderful job the tummy does. All those different types of food, it can process them, usually with a minimal amount of fuss. Sometimes we have to give special diets and things to help with the digestion and make sure that it gives us less problems. But generally, it works quite well and provides us with the energy we need to come here for this meditation and to carry us around each day. Thank you, tummy. Mindfully moving our awareness and this kindness up into our lungs, where we breathe. Such an important part of this meditation is the breath. Why it's so important? I feel it's so important because this is the meditation object, the breath. This is the meditation object that the Buddha used to gain enlightenment. How wonderful that is, that we have a breath that can be used as a tool for our meditation. So I really send some love and kindness to my lungs, my diaphragm, the trachea, the bronchial tubes, the windpipes, all the little bits and pieces and muscles and nose and everything and mouth that helps me to breathe. As this becomes later on, we'll look at this as a meditation, part of our meditation object. Which can not only allow the mind to get into some very deep meditations, but like I said, this is what the Buddha used himself to entry into enlightenment. So thank you, lungs, for giving me the breath. And then we move our awareness and this kindness, this loving kindness to ourself, up into our shoulders, sometimes a place where stress manifests. How do we know this? Because it always feels so good when someone gives us a shoulder massage. So maybe you just give your shoulders a mental massage of kindness, moving that awareness down the arms, the elbows, and into the hands and all the little muscles and bones in the hands and fingers, sending their kindness down there. And finally, we move that attention up into our neck. All those muscles in our neck. And then into our head and the face. All the little muscles around the eyes and the mouth to allow us to smile. It's a good opportunity to have a sneaky little smile while no one's looking. So with the meditation now, what we've just done is we've gone through the body, done a body sweep meditation. Develop this kindness that will keep, sustain, keep, move through to the next stage of the meditation. Because with meditation, it's always about having the five senses relaxed. Sense of taste, sound, touch, sight, and smell. Our eyes, the sight is largely kind of calmed down because we've closed our eyes. We've calmed the sense of touch through the body sweep meditation. Sense of smell and taste are largely calmed because of the fact we're not eating. So the five senses, we've made them as comfortable and as relaxed as possible. And in meditation, we always like to think of the sixth sense. The sixth sense is always the mind. So what we do now, we've calmed the five senses down, and we shift our awareness and our focus to the mind. Not forgetting to bring with us all the kindness that we've developed through the body sweep meditation. So now, for the rest of the meditation, we're going to hang out with our minds like a good friend. Just being with it, being with whatever states come up in the mind. Pleasant or unpleasant. We're just happy to be there with our minds like a good friend. We might ask ourselves the question, what is the mind? What am I looking at? Who am I hanging out with? How can I hang out with myself if I am myself? Who am I hanging out with? There's not two of me here, it's just me. It's just a nice way to look at it. By looking at it as that way, it makes it easier to explain the meditation. So it's basically yourself hanging out with yourself. And when you're looking at your mind, it can manifest itself in different ways depending on the type of mindset you have. So when I first start hanging out with the mind, it's a kind of a visual sensation. That's how it feels for me. It's like a television screen that's blank. And I know from experience, all the meditations I've done, that when my meditation is moving along, the screen has visual cues. It has swirling patterns of light and shapes. They're quite pleasant, quite calming. And for me, I know that's how my meditation is moving along. But for whatever type of mindset people have, you just hang out with whatever's happening in your own mind. For this guided meditation, you'll notice that what's in your mind is probably how your mind is representing my words that I'm speaking. Between my words, there's spaces. So when you're hanging out with your mind, you observe those spaces. This is meditation. There's no right way or wrong way. You're basically hanging out with your mind and you're observing what's going on. Experience in meditation and with some instructions, we learn about what I was alluding to before, breath meditation. This is, like I said before, what the Buddha used to get into enlightenment, and it's also what Ajahn Brahm likes to teach. It's written about in the suttas, in the Buddha's suttas as well. Breath meditation. It's also about hanging out with yourself, but you're hanging out with the breath, becoming a friend with the breath. Usually when you're have some experience in meditation, you don't need to take the mind to the breath. As the mind becomes peaceful, the breath comes up by itself. It becomes in your mind's view. It becomes in your mind's obvious. It becomes an object all by itself. But there's also nothing wrong when you're learning meditation to also gently shift the mind to the breath, to observe it, each in breath and out breath. And to note how it feels. Not to control the breath and to let the breath come in and out how it wants to. Sometimes it'll just be calm and gentle and soft and hardly noticeable. Other times you'll need to take a big deep breath in and a fast breath out. You just hang out with it and observe it and make peace. Be kind and be gentle. Why is the breath so important to hang out with? Why is it a meditation object that the Buddha used? And why is it something that Ajahn Brahm continually teaches to use over and over and over? Because it has a quality to it. That allows you to sustain your attention on it. And that quality, Ajahn Brahm refers to, he's come up with a nice word. He used to call it the beautiful breath. He called it the beautiful breath because it has some qualities that are quite pleasant. Those sorts of qualities that he's referring to that are pleasant is the sensations that the mind feels. I won't say the body, the mind feels those sensations. As you allow the breath meditation to progress, the sensation of the breath, the texture of the breath changes from how you normally sense the breath. Most of the time we don't even normally notice our breath. Don't take the time to see how it feels. But if you did, you'd notice that it has a coarseness to it, a roughness. It has a bit of a rough edge. But as you meditate and allow the mind to rest gently and calmly on the breath, it changes texture. Its feeling changes. It becomes a beautiful breath, or what Ajahn Brahm has referred to in more recent time as the delightful breath. It has a feeling of silkiness, softness, lightness, effortlessness. As you breathe in and out, the breath comes in and out through the breath comes in and out through the lungs and through your throat, it has a different feeling. It is very silky, it's soft, it's very pleasant, and it's accompanied with peace. That's the deal breaker. That's when it's a very, very nice way to know that your meditation is moving along. It's not that difficult for most meditators with a little bit of practice to achieve this delightful breath. See why the Buddha used it as an object to get into the deeper stages of meditation and enlightenment. It's delightful, it's pleasant, and it's accompanied by peace. if you haven't experienced it before, you might not know what to look for. So that's why I've given a few tasters, a few guidelines on what the beautiful breath is and what to look out for. But generally, with the beautiful breath, we don't force our mind onto it. We allow it to come up by itself. This is where I'm going to give an opportunity for everyone to do the next 10 minutes of meditation without me speaking. So you're basically going to hang out with your mind and just be happy to be there and be friendly to be with whatever comes up in the mind. Always making peace, being kind and being gentle. And then at the end of the meditation, I'll ring the gong 3 times. Okay, now we're starting to get close to the end of the meditation. But before we end the meditation, please just review what happened in the last 30 minutes in your mind. One way to do this is to look at your peaceometer. It's like a speedometer in a car, but this one measures your peace. And the closer it is to zero, the closer the needle is to zero, the more peace you have. So just have a look, see how peaceful you've been, and if there are any moments of peace that came up, or if there was any moments of agitation, just remember those things and what little things helped you to get towards a more peaceful state. So I'm going to end the meditation by ringing the gong 3 times. Please keep your eyes closed until you hear the third ring of the gong, and then come out of meditation. Thank you for sharing that meditation with me. Very enjoyable. Yeah, so so many things I feel like talking about with meditation. So I kind of got to hold myself back and stop and let everyone have a little meditation on their own. But the biggest thing that I feel with the meditation, like you might have picked up on, is that the kindness, you have to have that through the meditation. I feel that that's one of the biggest tricks, that's one of the biggest things to develop with meditation, is being kind to yourself. And I'm quite lucky. I've had 7 years of practice at the monastery to be able to do that, because living a busy life, it's not when I was in engineering before, it's a little bit harder because you've got to deal with different people at work and all that. I've got to deal with other monks. How easy is that? They're all just these calm people that are trying their best to be live a calm life, so it's a bit of a blessed life. I'm very, very privileged, very lucky, and to be living in Australia with Ajahn Brahm as a teacher, and the support that he gets, I'm very well looked after, and I feel that won't be any different down in Albany either. There's the same sort of support down there. You go travelling and get mistaken for Ajahn Brahm all the time. Sometimes I just let it go on a bit. Oh, no, it's someone else. But, I had a lovely meditation, and it always helps with the group. You know, one person told me that when you meditate sometimes with just like having one candle, it's not a very bright light. But when you've got all these people with all their candles, you get a very bright mind. It's quite nice. So I felt that here, and I always feel that with the guided meditations that I do. So thank you very much. I would like to ask anyone if they've got any questions, because I did go a little bit over time with my chit-chatting, waffling on. Yes, please.
Okay. I was told recently that we go through life with a couple of forces happening, dark and light. And it's very easy for us to get drawn into the darkness. We can fall into it almost automatically.
Yeah.
But to get out of it, you've got to invite the light in. So you've got that opposing thing about easily fall into the dark, but you've got to invite the light. And I was just wondering what the Buddhist take on that is, or what the Buddha would say.
Yeah. Well, I don't know exactly what the Buddha would say, but I've been learning Buddhism for the last 7 years, so my take on that is that's kind of a bit like a metaphor. You know, this kind of dark, and I can relate to it because I can put myself in the situation where I was before I became a monk, and I led quite a wholesome life, but I was inclined to see a negative in things all the time, and that's the dark that I feel you're talking about. I'd always see the bad in people, and it was easy to do, really easy. I'd see the way people didn't recycle things properly or something like that, didn't do it the way I would do it, and that would kind of make me agitated. And I found that the older I got, the worse that got. And that was one of the things I was lucky enough to pick up in myself, and I kind of didn't want that anymore. I wanted to see people in a better light. I wanted to see the good things in people rather than the bad things in people. But I was so easily drawn to the bad things I saw in people, their negative properties. And really, you heard Ajahn Brahm's story about the two bad bricks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but you haven't, have you? So I'm going to quickly go over the two bad bricks, because this is a perfect question. So Ajahn Brahm, 30 years ago, I think, roughly 30 years ago, they bought the monastery in Serpentine. And they didn't have the support that's there now, so they had to build everything themselves, with a little bit of support from the local community, Buddhist community, and Thai families, and traditional Buddhist families. So a lot of wives from Asian countries, they have Aussie husbands, and so those people came. So these Aussie husbands that come and help out laying bricks, some of them were bricklayers, some of them were painters. And anyway, so Ajahn Brahm learned how to build brick walls. He learned how to bricklay. So he had a crack at laying bricks, and when he built this wall, it was actually the toilet block, the ablution block at the monastery. When he was building that, because he's a bit of a perfectionist, he did get through all of his schooling on scholarships. He came from a poor family in London, so he was very smart, and he's a bit of a perfectionist, so he wanted the wall to be perfect. But unfortunately, after building this wall, it had two bad bricks. Two wobbly ones, two wonky ones. They were shocking. And he was so upset, he actually got quite angry from the way he describes this, that he wanted to get some dynamite and blow this wall up. And he came to his senses and realised that was a bit silly. So he just kept building and tried to hide these two flaws. But one day, a builder came along to the monastery, and it was Ajahn Brahm's job to show people around the monastery, show them what was going on, and encourage people to support the monastery with donations and help with building costs and so forth. So he took them down to this building that he'd just been completed, which was the ablution block for the monks, and he on purpose didn't show them the two bad bricks. He kept them away from that wall. But this builder, you know, he took it on himself, and he just kind of had a look around and went and stood back, crossed his arms, and he looked at the wall. He said, "That's a bloody beautiful wall." And Ajahn Brahm says, "Are you mad? Are you crazy? Can't you see the two bad bricks in it? It's a shocking wall." And this builder, this is where Ajahn Brahm says, he was wiser than he was. He says, "Yes, I can see the two bad bricks, but I can also see the 998 good ones." And the builder said, I'd call that a feature wall and charge an extra couple of grand." So yeah, Ajahn Brahm, that's one of his most famous stories, and it basically says, you know, look at the 998 good bricks, don't focus on the two bad bricks. So this is what got me out of seeing the faults in everybody, and I developed that over the years by staying at the monastery, and because I had to do the same thing again. So I've got you know, 30 brothers at the monastery. They've all come from different backgrounds, and they're all going to grate on you one way or another. So you've got to learn to live with these guys. You've got no choice. So, and especially the first year, like Anagarika Simon over there, he's stuck in the kitchen with them from 6:30 in the morning till 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I get to run away, I have my lunch, I go back to the hut. And again, because Simon has to battle it out in the kitchen with all these egos. They're very close, it's a tiny kitchen. Ajahn Brahm did it on purpose. He made the kitchen small so that these guys could it was a testing ground, you know, and whoever doesn't make it through, you know, they leave. But lately, everyone's been staying. In my crew, when I was at Agarica, I'm the only one left out of the five of us. A couple stayed on and became monks, but they disrobed, and I'm the only one that's left. But it is a lovely place to be as well, but it can also be, it can be very tense in there, because you're rushing to get the meal on the table for the monks, and you're kind of like, he's not peeling carrots the way I peel them, have to be peeled that way, not this way, and it can be over little things like that. So yeah, you've got to learn to kind of see those the good qualities and try to disregard the bad ones. So you've got your dark light and your light force and dark force. So the way I'm kind of looking at your question is that how do you bring the light in? Well, you look at the 998 good bricks and you try and disregard the two bad ones. And I found that extremely helpful. It works. I've seen people come to the monastery that really annoy me. And I'm just fine with them now. And as you give them that, because they've got all the other monks and all the other community members giving them a hard time, if you're that one person that's nice to them and says, oh, well done, you know, I like the way you did that job, so kind of give them a pat on the back for their 998 good bricks, then when you go back to your hut each night, you can sleep and you don't have a problem with this fellow anymore. So it's 998 good bricks, 2 bad bricks. Ajahn Brahm's brick wall analogy. Look it up on YouTube. There's lots of people have retold it. I think I'm surprised if there wouldn't be a cartoon about it, because there's been cartoons about all of his stories. There's a book called Kangaroo Guru. Has anyone seen that? Oh wow, it is awesome, and it was published in 2012. And I only saw it like last week. Some Singaporeans did. You've got a library here, haven't you? Mm-hmm. It should be in there. Because people like me that can't read, it's like comics, it's like a cartoon. It's got all of his stories in there. And the 2 bad bricks is in there too. It's called Kangaroo Guru. I'm surprised no one's seen it. It's awesome. Yeah. Yeah, so I hope that kind of alluded to that, but I can relate to this dark force, and I think people can get sucked into it pretty easy. It's easier to see the bad bricks and the good ones, but with a little bit of practice, and sometimes you've got to fake it till you make it, but that works. And sometimes you bite your tongue and you don't say the bad things, you don't give them a hard time about their bad things, you just tell them the good stuff they've done. Because we got this monk at the monastery, he likes to do all the environmental stuff, and he really does a good job. He looks after the weeds and he looks after the pruning of the trees, but not everyone agrees with what's a weed and what's a tree that's not a weed. So we've got a forest to deal with there, so we've got all these different opinions. And, you know, and I don't like cutting down trees myself, so I had a bit of a problem with him when he first came as well. But I can see in his heart he's really trying to do the best for the environment. And he might cut a few trees down that I don't like that have been cut down, but overall I think he does it much. He does more good than bad. So I've managed to keep on his good side. That's a good thing, because you don't want, in a monastery you want harmony, and in that everyday life in your families you want harmony as well, and you should always try and work, do your utmost to try and keep harmony, because then you can sleep at night, you don't have any enemies, or you have very few enemies, because I really only had kind of one enemy, and that was kind of my wife.
Mm.
And then when I did the forgiveness ceremony, that went. Now I have zero. How cool is that? I can go to sleep every night with happy. Yeah. Well, there's still a bit more time. Is there any other questions? Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, briefly. Okay. So, Ajahn Brahm gave a description of this, and he had to do the same thing at the monastery because he had a problem with one of the other monks. So when he described it, I thought, I'll have a crack at this. Because I was at the monastery for 5 years, and then my daughter rang me up from Kununurra. She said, can you come up to my graduation, my year 12 graduation? It was Mum's idea. I'm like, oh, okay, wow, that's weird. Haven't spoken to her for 5 years. And so she said, yeah, that was Mum's idea. You come up to the... come up here. And so I asked Ajahn Brahm, and some supporters put together a ticket for me to fly up to Kununurra, because it's like 2 or 3 days drive if you don't fly there. And then I had accommodation there at this hotel, and my daughter lived a street away, so she brought me my meal every day. And before I left, I had all the monks, because they'd known some of the story, they had all these gifts. Said, I'll give this to your wife, and give her this message, and this is for your daughter. So I had all this stuff. It was mainly chocolate, because that's the only currency monks can deal with. Dark chocolate. The only thing we're kind of allowed to have. So I had all this dark chocolate. And you know what the temperature's like in Kununurra? I quickly got it into the fridge as soon as I got there, but I think some of it melted. So I had this plan. I'm going to do the forgiveness ceremony with my wife and see if it works, see if Ajahn Brahm's technique really works, or if it's just something he made up. So I had this plan. I'll ask my daughter to arrange a meeting. So my wife picked me up from the airport with my daughter and dropped me off, and it was okay. It was a little bit funny feeling, tense, but I said to my daughter, can you ask Mum if we can catch up sometime before I go back? Because I was only there for 3 or 4 days, and I didn't see my wife during that time. I just saw my daughter. I can understand why, that's fine. So she said, I don't know, that's a bit weird. My mum, and my daughter's kind of quite nervous, so I don't think she did anything. So on the last night I was there, my wife comes to pick me up to take me to the graduation ceremony at the school. And she's a teacher there. So she has to, you know, introduce me to all of her teachers. Yeah.
You still wear your uniform, you still wear your
robe. Of course, yeah. So I'm standing out like a sore thumb.
I'm this
yeah, all the high vis workers in Kununurra. I'm there standing out like a sore thumb in this brown bed sheets. So she takes me along, she's got to introduce me to the principal and all her mates, the school teachers and stuff like that. And on the way back home in the car after the ceremony, I said, did Georgia ask you about catching up? Because I wanted to meet with you. I've got some stuff from the monastery that the monks have got a gift for you. She said, no, she didn't say anything. Oh yeah, figured as such. I said, well, I've got this stuff, and can we catch up before I leave tomorrow on the aeroplane? She says, fine, I'll come over after school finishes tomorrow at 3:30 before you go to your flight at 4. I think she said 3, so I had half an hour. She comes over and said, do you want a cup of tea? So she makes a cup of tea, we sit down, have a bit of a chat. I bring out all the goodies. And I've got chocolates, I've got a friend, one of the supporters owns a tourist shop, so she had all these bits and bobs, and so I gave her those things as well. She said, oh, that's sweet, and that's lovely, and Venerable Upasama, do you all know him? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he wrote a crazy note, because he's good at them, so he wrote this crazy note for her. I said, I've got no idea what he's written on this, but he is known as the eccentric monk in the monastery, so don't blame me for what he says. And she read it and said, oh, that's so sweet. So whatever he said was quite good. And then I said, look, I've got a couple of things I want to say. And I know for the last, how old was my daughter then? Okay, so she was 17. I said, for the last 17 years, I know I've been a bit of an arsehole. And we've gone through a lot through the family law court. And I know I've caused you a lot of grief, and I know I've caused your family a lot of grief. And I'm really sorry. And I ask if you can forgive me. And at that point, she started crying. And I knew I was forgiven. And this weight just lifted off my shoulders, because I had this, it was like a shadow looming over me all the time. I knew I hadn't resolved with her our problem, family law court and that. And you know, I felt she did a lot of things to me that were hurtful as well, but I didn't ask her to, I didn't say, well, you've got to forgive me now. I just left it at that. I said, please forgive me. So that was really good. And then I extended that to her family. I said, to your parents as well, please pass on my apology and ask them for forgiveness as well. And that basically was very similar to how Ajahn Brahm did his forgiveness ceremony with the abbot at the time, who disrobed now. And he had an issue over the building, how they wanted to build a certain part of the monastery, and they had a bit of a biff about it. So he went and saw him at his hut privately and did it the Buddhist way, with a tray with three incenses, three flowers and three candles, and asked for forgiveness that way. And that, he said, that was wonderful. So that's how I did it. It worked for me. And when she dropped me off later on that afternoon at the airport, like I said before, she said, she was very happy. She said, I'll see you at the wedding. Which to me meant, you know, it's all cool, and you know, next time we'll see each other, it'll be on good terms. So I would recommend that. Yes.
You sure she didn't just want more chocolate?
Well, that's a good point. Because we get good chocolate in the monastery. We're very lucky.
Sorry, can I ask, I know we're out of time, what is it with monks and chocolate? I knew this. And
oh, yeah.
And so where did they... talking about chocolate and monks, what is it with chocolate?
Well, there was... one of our monks' rules is that we have our a main meal. We have to have that before noon each day. But if there is a situation comes up where we don't get a meal, then, and this happened in the time of the Buddha, and the monks walked on Bindabar, they walked for their food, and they took their alms bowl with us. Where we are, we're very lucky, we get the food comes to us, and 365 days a year, food comes to our monastery without fail. So, if food doesn't come, the Buddha allowed us to have sweets that we could keep for 7 days. So, normally, whatever food we get that day, we have to eat that. If there's any left over, we have to forfeit it, throw it away, or basically, yeah, we get charity pickup. Bob comes along, takes that. But we are allowed to eat chocolate for 7 days. So if you gave me dark chocolate with no nuts in it, I can't have any food in it. It's considered a tonic, a medicine, something that can carry you through. Medicine's not a good word for it, but that's what they...
Energy pills.
Yeah, it gives you energy, so yeah. So we can have chocolate. Sorry?
It's a survival pack.
It's a survival pack, yeah. Same thing. And we're allowed to have sweets as well, but I've had so many years of those, I'm a bit they like, and the chocolate, basically. I don't need it because we get so much food at the monastery. I'm just happy to have some fruit juice in the evening, where they have juice as well. So I can trade my chocolate. So that's smiles. I give it to people and they smile. So my family, when I go see mum and dad in Mandurah, or my daughter, I always got a couple of bars of chocolate. You know, there you go. Because I haven't got money. I can't buy them a gift, but I can give them chocolate. Yeah. So thank you for having me here today.
Thank you for inviting me.
There's a joke from Ajahn Brahma I forgot to read out.
Please.
Okay.
No, we need the mic so we can...
All right. What about this one? Does this one work?
Yeah,
of course. Testing, okay. It's an in-joke for Buddhists, so if you don't get it, come and see me afterwards, Alex. Is it true that Donald Trump has overnight decided to be a Buddhist?
Wow.
He just learned that his self... is fake news. Okay, blame our jump around for that. Thank you.
Oh, this group is great. It's a big group.
Yeah. Gee whiz.